From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Malcolm McLaren is best known as the former manager of the legendary punk rock band, the Sex Pistols. In an essay for Wired magazine, McLaren wrote, quote, "We live in a karaoke culture. The Japanese word means empty orchestra, a lifeless musical form unencumbered by creativity and free of responsibility. Simple, clean fun for the millennial nuclear family. You can't fail in a karaoke world. It's life by proxy, liberated by hindsight." End quote. Well, today, we're going to explore this karaoke world. It's a world that includes karaoke capitalism, karaoke fascism, rock star Gomaroki, and a novel fittingly called The Karaoke World of Cortez Hare. First, Brian Raftery is the author of Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. Here's Raftery reading an excerpt.
I love karaoke. I love it without qualifiers, apologies, or actual singing talent. When people talk about the adrenaline rush that comes with playing competitive sports or putting angel dust in their eyelids, I think, yes, that's fine, but have you ever performed Benny and the Jets in a hot tub? For years, I've employed karaoke as both a stimulant and an antidepressant, and I've traveled the world seeking out the perfect karaoke experience, whether it's in a Filipino bar in Vienna or a wedding reception in South Dakota. My affection for karaoke is so severe, I've even made two separate trips to Japan, the place where the words kara, or empty, and okestra, for orchestra, were first combined, and where the art of the sing-along has undergone nearly 40 years of scrutiny and refinement. In Japan, you can sing all over the city, from minuscule private rooms, which are called K-boxes, for karaoke box, to lavishly futuristic suites. The Japanese even have a special karaoke password, Nomi Hodai. It's pronounced kind of like an Irish pimp's lament. No, Mihodai. And it somehow translates as unlimited drinks. When used properly, Nomi Hodai will yield non-stop trays of cheap beers, which will invariably be delivered by a cute waitress. Going to Japan for karaoke isn't so much a vacation as it is a pilgrimage. A heaven on earth where you can actually perform Belinda Carlisle's Heaven is a Place on Earth. I always suspected there were other karaoke fiends out there, but up until a few years ago, I couldn't find many of them. From 1999 to 2002, when my friends and I were going to New York City karaoke bars on just about every other weekend, I'd often invite coworkers or casual acquaintances to come along with us. And they usually looked at me as though I'd just asked them to help officiate a cockfight. In many ways, I could empathize with their reluctance, as I've occasionally suffered from my own karaoke pursuits. You don't know the human body's threshold for pain until you've been stuck on a Scandinavian cruise ship at 2 in the morning, watching an international karaoke contest, and listening to My Heart Will Go On for the third time in as many hours. It's enough to make you consider those rolling black sheets of the Baltic Sea as a viable exit strategy. Karaoke requires the willingness to be entertained by strangers, and many of those strangers, admittedly, are complete chuckleheads, including myself. So I understand why some people still dismiss it as a lowbrow lark, and are repulsed by the idea of going anywhere near a karaoke bar. But I've simply learned to treat these people the same way my religious friends treat me. Outwardly supportive, but always secretly hoping for an awakening.
That's Brian Raftery, reading from his book Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. As Raftery writes in his book, karaoke started in Japan in the early 1970s.
And it's strange. I mean, obviously, you know, Japanese culture, which has changed a lot in the last generation, but, you know, traditionally, it's a more reserved culture. And one of the reasons why karaoke has worked there is because they really don't do it in the Western style. If you go to Japan, you're not going to find a lot of those, you know, big sort of empty bars where there's a little stage and there's about 40 or 50 people eventually filling up to watch you sing. They really enjoy doing it in these private little rooms. And they do business meetings there. A lot of kids after school would wind up going to these K-box rooms. And, you know, I think a part of it is because Japan has an amazing music curriculum in their schools. I mean, music is very much drilled into these kids from an early age. And a big part of Japanese culture for a while was perfecting one song. I mean, that speaks to that sort of Japanese history of discipline and perfection. So people would learn this one song sort of as a way to entertain guests. It became kind of a disciplinary, you know, sort of a way to show off how well you could train yourself to sing. And then it kind of evolved into all these people having these very rambunctious private room parties in Japan where they sang and then kind of walking out into the usual sort of reserved Japanese culture that was outside.
Hmm. What's interesting in a way, I suppose, is that it made this shift. You actually met the guy who invented the first karaoke machine, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And I felt a slight affinity because he was also a failed musician. He was a jazz drummer in the early 70s. And
what was his name?
Is Daisuke Inoue. I believe he's probably about 70 years old now. I met him about 2 years or so ago. And he's a very sweet guy, and he wanted to be a drummer when he was growing up. He benefited from this very intensive music curriculum when he was in a Japanese high school, in elementary school. So he wanted to be a jazz drummer, but he realized he didn't have the chops for it. So he sort of moved into putting on shows at nightclubs and organizing bands. And, you know, he saw that occasionally people would be in a tiny little Japanese bar, which are called snacks. They're really small bars, maybe three or four people are there with the hostess. And someone would come with a guitar and start playing, or sometimes there'd be a piano, and people would sing along. So he looked at that and thought, well, I can make money off this if I eliminate the middleman. I mean, why would I have to pay for a musician if I can just find a machine, just make a machine that actually plays the songs for them? And that's what he did. He made this little, basically took like a speaker amplifier and a vending machine and an 8-track machine and kind of scrunched it all together to make this, you know, very tiny but still kind of bulky and inconvenient sing-along device. So he spent a couple of years in Japan hustling these machines, and, you know, it took a while for him to actually get a reception there as well.
I was curious. I mean, did he have success getting people to pick it up, or was it something that, because of the tradition in Japan, most of the cafe owners would be questioning?
No, I mean, he didn't have a trouble getting into the few bars at first because he had friends who ran a lot of these nightclubs and sort of small snack bars. But what saved him was the Japanese after-hours culture, after-work culture, has a long and lasting drunk businessman sort of culture. So what he did was, the first few weeks when it wasn't working well, he realized that he had to get these businessmen, or salarymen as they're called, to sing. That was going to be his key audience. So he started hiring very attractive hostesses that he knew from around the city to go into the bars and just sort of pretend as if they just suddenly discovered this karaoke machine. And so they would start singing. This woman would start singing and then hand off the microphone halfway through to some businessman who clearly was not going to, you know, turn down, you know, the gestures of a beautiful young woman who wanted him to sing. And that actually helped him. I mean, he really says that was a turning point in that first month between no one putting any coins in this machine and then suddenly his machines were so popular that, you know, the coins were sort of short-circuiting the wiring after a while.
But he didn't patent it. Why not?
He didn't. I mean, he thought all of his relatives told him to patent it, but he believed that patenting at that point in Japan was a very laborious process. It was very expensive, apparently, to patent things in Japan, and he didn't really think he'd invented anything. He felt like, well, I just brought these three sort of pre-existing technologies together. So he never patented. He wound up patenting these sort of little slipcase lyrics books that they use in Japan, but he didn't make much money off that. So, you know, people meet him and assume he's, you know, a gazillionaire. I mean, but he doesn't even own the rights to the word karaoke, or karaoke, as it's pronounced in Japan. I mean, he's made very little money off this, you know, after he left the industry in the early 90s.
Too bad, because it's turned into a big thing here. But it wasn't when it came here. In fact, when it first came, it was really ridiculed, wasn't it? Why did it take so long to become part of American culture, do you think?
Well, it's strange because, you know, Americans and Western culture were so exhibitive. We're usually the first ones to sort of jump on stage. But I think we had a couple of hang-ups at that point in our culture. I think when pop music came along and recorded pop stars came along, it sort of changed the tradition of how we sing in this country. The Civil War, people would sing. You know, turn of the century, people would sing. They didn't really care if they had talent or not. They would walk around singing a cappella with friends. It was something you did socially. And when we suddenly had, you know, these giant pop stars moving in with the recorded era, we had someone to judge ourselves against. I mean, we could see that Dean Martin or whoever was a big pop singer at that time or a vocalist was far better at singing these songs than we were. And I think in a strange way that really kind of ingrained this weird sort of insecurity in Americans. Like, you know, well, there are people who are supposed to sing and people who aren't. And the people who are supposed to sing, we will build them up. We will make them icons of our entire culture. And if you can't sing, you should just stay off the stage. And I think that's what happened a lot in America. I think we had a lot of hang-ups about our own ability. I think we felt very self-conscious about getting up in front of others and doing something that
we frankly really couldn't do as well as others, and everyone would be able to tell that we couldn't do as well.
So on the one hand, you have very private Japan, where this became immensely popular, and very exhibitionist America, where we refused to believe that anyone wanted to hear us sing. You've been all over the world. Is that the extent of the range, or is it different everywhere you go?
Well, I think Americans were certainly the last to really pick up on karaoke. I mean, we've had it started to become a stronger industry in America in the early 90s, and then it kind of had a little falling out in the mid-90s, and now it's pretty much bigger than ever. But around the world, once it got out of Asia in the late 70s, early 80s, it really picked up everywhere. In fact, I've gone to a couple of these international karaoke competitions. One was in Bangkok, and one was on this cruise ship that went between Estonia and Finland. And I'd meet people from Europe and Asia, and most people I met would always lay claim that their country was the country that really broke karaoke. I mean, they'd pull me aside and say, well, you know, the Japanese, they may have more. But here in Finland, you know, we were doing it quicker before anyone else. Everyone had this pride about that they were the karaoke country. So we were kind of the last country to get on that, which is very strange.
Yeah. But once here, of course, it's really taken off. I don't know exactly what the explanation is. Is it American Idol that made it popular?
I think American Idol is part of it. I mean, the success of karaoke in the last 7 or 8 years and the success of American Idol during that same time, they have a very symbiotic relationship. On the one hand, American Idol certainly wouldn't have this pool of contestants who are 14 years old and already know where their pitch is and already know what vibrato is if they weren't practicing at home with karaoke machines. I mean, at-home karaoke machines were introduced in the late 90s, and this was a huge step forward for the industry because teenagers like to sing no matter what. You know, at a certain age, they sort of stop and become self-conscious, but very young kids will naturally sing. I was one of them. But you couldn't do it anywhere. I mean, karaoke was always restricted to bars. So once these at-home machines came out, you suddenly had all these young teenagers who were singing at home at slumber parties or birthday parties. So American Idol certainly benefited from that. At the same time, karaoke has benefited from what American Idol has sort of taught us about singing. I mean, American Idol makes singing look like the most fun, exciting activity in the world. Even if you don't like the show, it's very hard to watch an episode of that, a good episode, and not kind of be singing along to yourself when the credits end. So I think they've certainly played a big role in how karaoke has become so widespread in the last couple of years. I mean, it really went from this activity that I would try to cajole people into doing in New York, where people are, you know, are much more open to doing these sort of things at night and have all kinds of crazy nightlife options, yet somehow karaoke was the weirdest thing to them. And now it's kind of evolved into, you know, you can't even get a room at most karaoke places now, and there's so many of them in New York. I mean, it's just, you know, there's no hang-ups anymore. It's not a weird thing. You don't say, hey, I did karaoke, isn't that crazy? It's, you know, it's like going to a birthday party or a bachelor party. It's just something that happens all the time in American life.
American Idol's kind of an interesting Americanization of karaoke, it seems to me, because in some ways you've combined what you talked about, the business of wanting only the best to do the singing. An American Idol, in some ways, while we laugh at the people who really can't sing, is the best of the karaoke singers.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. And I actually think as someone who's, I mean, I'm not a karaoke purist. And I'm not a good singer. And I've always sort of hated the few times I've been at karaoke bars and people would sort of boo or make fun. And my big problem with American Idol is that, you know, people compare it to karaoke, but really, what American Idol does when they sort of trot out all those contestants that can sing and sort of hold them up in this very sort of mean-spirited way, that is kind of the opposite of what karaoke is about. I mean, karaoke is really about just feeling comfortable and singing and not feeling as if you're being judged. So I've always sort of felt that American Idol, by, you know, really cruelly lampooning some of these people who are not talented singers, they've kind of gone against the tenets of karaoke in a way. And it's one of the reasons I've been sort of turned off by the show in recent seasons, even though they produce amazing vocalists, many of whom started out doing karaoke.
What's the most memorable karaoke experience you've ever had?
Oh, I've had a couple. I mean, certainly, as eccentric as this sounds, my wife and I had karaoke at our wedding reception. Not at the actual wedding, which would have been a little bit too much. But, you know, we had karaoke at our reception. And, you know, most of our friends at this point have either been converted to karaoke fandom themselves or were always fans or sort of begrudgingly accepted the fact that they're going to have to watch us sing karaoke. So, you know, my wife and I sang karaoke and I sang with my family. My father and I and the rest of my family sang New York, New York, which was the song that he had sung at the karaoke bar in Hawaii 20 years ago. And it was the first time I'd heard him ever sing, really, at that point. So that's been really fun. But a lot of the experiences in Japan have been my favorite. They've been my most memorable. I've always gone there with friends who love Japan and love the many things that Japan has to offer, but we mostly really love the karaoke more than anything. And we would get these private rooms, and sometimes it's a tiny little room where you have one little couch and a little sort of weird sort of remote control that looks like it was made in 2095 that somehow has tens of thousands of songs in it, which are amazing. Or sometimes you can go into these very lavish, weird, kind of tacky, sort of futuristic suites. And my friend and I actually once wound up singing in a hot tub in Japan. I don't remember exactly how we wound up there, but I know that they gave us rental swimming trunks, which was pretty amazing, and a wireless microphone. So we're standing in these like jacuzzis and with these wireless microphones. And I was like, you know, I don't know how Japan's voltage regulations are. So it's like, if I drop this right now, I could be dead. But it's like, you know, at the same time, if I were to go out in a Japanese hot tub singing Benny and the Jets by Elton John, I mean, that's pretty appropriate. There are far more embarrassing ways to go.
Brian Rafferty is the author of Don't Stop Believin', How Karaoke Conquered the World and Changed My Life. If you've ever wanted to front your own rock band, you could take the traditional route. Get a bunch of musicians together and spend endless days and nights rehearsing until you're ready to start playing some gigs. Or you could just head over to the High Noon Saloon in Madison, Wisconsin on a Tuesday night for Rockstar Gomaroki. Rockstar Gomaroki, it's a variation on karaoke, in which you sing along with a live band instead of a pre-recorded karaoke track. And why is it called Gomaroki? Because it features the encyclopedic and eclectic musical stylings of the Gomers, a comedy rock, experimental music, progressive rock band based here in Madison. We sent, to the best of our knowledge, producer and senior karaoke correspondent Doug Gordon to Rockstar Gomaroki.
Welcome to Rockstar Gomaroki, where you can get everything and nothing together in one package. Yeah. Thank you so much.
One of the Gomaroki regulars is Frasier. He used to be known as Mr. Showbiz, but he's been promoted.
It's Dr. Showbiz. He's got his honorary doctorate in showbiz.
How you doing, man? Regular karaoke, you know, it's a computer. There's no flexibility there. You're singing it supposedly just like the song was recorded for everybody to hear. So Gomaroki, you know it your way, and the band knows it their way, you know, with the crowd. And every time you sing, you might sing the same song every time, but each time it's going to be a little bit different just because it's live band. It's a bunch of different musicians working together.
There is a house in New Orleans. They call the rising sun. It's been the ruin of many a poor boy, and God, I know I'm one.
Tom Schwartz is another Gomaroki veteran.
This goes out to B. Arthur and Dom DeLuise.
We've all sung in the shower before, after all. And it makes you wonder, could I possibly go on stage and actually make this work? Could I pull it off? And here you get the opportunity to do that, to try, certainly.
Well, I got another town about an hour ago. I took a look around, so it's where the wind blows. Well, and a little girl in a Hollywood bungalow.
We all live in a weird society, and everybody's got tension that builds up, and then we all look for ways to let that tension out constructively and non-harmfully. People have talked about primal scream therapy for a long time. I've used this experience as an opportunity to get up and scream my lungs out in front of a large number of people before, and where else could that happen?
And Gomaroki wouldn't be Gomaroki without the effervescent Terry Lynn Lane. She's been singing Gomaroki since the beginning.
Oh, Terry, hold on, hold on, hold on. Yeah.
was feeling kind of sentimental about Rush because last July I sang a Rush song, and that was the night that I met my boyfriend, and now he's my fiance.
Though his mind is not correct, don't put him down as arrogant. Serve a quiet defense, writing out the these events. The river.
Gomoroki is about the everyday Joes. There are people that come here from all different walks of life, different work experiences, different friend networks, and this is the one thing that draws all of us together. And it's drawing you out of your daily humdrum existence where sometimes, frankly, maybe somebody doesn't really give a crap about, you know, as long as you show up for work. But here, for 5 minutes, you can be on stage and be a rock star and have fun and have people applaud you and get a free drink. And it's a totally fun, good vibe experience. And I have met so many fun people. And I've had so many of my friends come here for various evenings, and it's such a bonding experience.
Right now, let's enjoy Swampy.
Another crowd pleaser is Richard Marsh, alias Swampy D. Swampy D has a very powerful voice, and the phrase reckless abandon is a great way to describe his performances. You never know what he's going to do. He may venture out into the crowd, as he did on this night.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. To everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Yeah, well, with every move he makes, another chance he takes. The odds are he won't live to see tomorrow.
As you've seen, I'm pretty spontaneous with what I do when I get up there. I don't like to just stand there all the time. I like to interact with the crowd. You know?
I have to say one thing about Swampy D. Whenever he sings, it doesn't matter where he is in the set, whenever he sings, all the girls get up and dance.
Secret agent man.
Rebecca Seitz says that performing Gomoroki is like going to music school.
The thing I think I love the most about performing with the Gomers is being surrounded by the sound. When you're in an audience or when you're listening to a stereo, it's very one-directional or two-directional. But when you're singing in the midst of the band and you hear it from all directions, it's much more being a part of the music and you can get really lost in it.
Oh, show me the way to the next whiskey bar. Oh, don't ask why.
And there's a lot of glamour in it, too. So, you know, there are the lights and there's the audience and the applause and people shouting your name and the Gomers saying you're part of the band and you get the free drink and at the end you want to say, tip your bartenders, and you feel like a rock star. And that's fun, but that doesn't last. And so what keeps me coming back is knowing that I'm learning how to perform among the best musicians that will let me play with them. And that's such an honor. And I feel free to mess up and know they're going to be supporting me behind me. So if I mess up the timing, they're going to catch me and they'll come around again and they'll nod to me when it's time to come in. And so it's much more forgiving than regular karaoke, because in regular karaoke, if you miss your cue, that's it. But if you've missed your verse or you've come in wrong, and Dave might start singing just to sort of get you into it. And I think they really go at it with an attitude of almost teachers, but also like cohorts, and they're really allies up there. So it's easy to feel like a musician up there more than just, you know, you're singing to a bouncing ball. It's much more integral. Really making music together is pretty special.
Rebecca.
Biff Uranus Blum from Gaginyong of the Gomers explains the difference between Gomeroki and other versions of live band karaoke.
We're the Gomers, and we know a million, trillion, zillion, 300,000 songs, and we can do them in any style, and we do them with a sense of tongue-in-cheek often, and we have a lot of fun with it, and we lift people up to the sky sometimes. It's goofy.
How do the Gomers approach songs they don't know very well?
It's a lot like the high dive. You climb up the steps, you get up there, and you jump a couple times, and you just dive right in. And sometimes the water's really close, and it's warm, and there's no sharks. And then other times, you keep falling, and suddenly you realize there's no water, but there was actually a cliff. And maybe there's a parachute, and maybe there's a trampoline, and maybe not.
I asked Biff Bloom from Gaganyum and fellow Gomers Steve Burke and Jeff Brady about their favorite Gomeroki memory.
There was a woman who came up who was extremely drunk, and she had a broken leg, so she was on crutches in a cast, in a fairly full leg cast, like it was a big boot that kind of went up to the knee area but down to the foot, and she started spinning around. I can't remember the song. It was probably like Oh Lord, Would You Buy Me Mercedes Benz or one of those other songs by her. And she was spinning, and she like kicked a mic stand over, and she kicked a guitar over, and she couldn't stop. She was drunk and invalid, basically. But she was in motion. And I just remember thinking, do you remember those like tops we used to have as kids? They were like battling tops or something, and you'd pull the string and they go woof, and
she really owned the stage, and she was jumping around with this big cast, like whipping back really close to all of us.
Yeah, she almost took out Dave a couple times, I think.
Took out the drums, too. Everyone got a turn, like where we almost got completely Crispin Glover style clocked, but with a big cast, you know? It was like, whatever, 80 pounds of cast.
You don't remember exactly what song, but it was probably a Janis Joplin song, because I was thinking it would have been only fitting if it were You Spin Me Round.
Spin Me Right Round. Bike. Yeah, it wasn't that, but yeah, that would have been the funniest thing was that she was holding her bad leg out and, you know, hopping on her, the good leg. And so it was like she was really kind of performing a cool feat of maneuverability for someone who was obviously in had a cast on and crutches, man. It was so funny. You spin me right.
Are there any songs that Jeff Brady and Steve Burke are sick of doing? The answer is no.
Well, the thing I like about doing the same songs over and over again is it's not really like we're doing the same song, because like the singers are always different. It's always a different sort of environment that automatically is created at every show. So even though we've done me and Bobby McGee say like 14,000 times, every time we do it, it doesn't seem like the same song totally, because the singer adds a new dynamic. It seems like the Gomeroki paradigm is one of constant self-renewal, and therefore I don't ever get sick of songs. Steve?
Wow, Jeff, I really like that. Paradigm of constant renewal.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that was our paradigm, and I have to say that I'd be honored and pleased if that were so, and I suspect you might be right. My take on it is that we put this out to the city and to the populace at general and to the world, you know, like come up, we'll play these songs. And so to pass judgment on what songs people bring up would be just really counter to the whole thing, the whole spirit, the whole idea behind this thing. And not only that, even if we do play a song, say like the one Jeff mentioned or Don't Stop Believin', we've done that probably hundreds of times. And each time you approach it new, and that's the challenge to a musician, to approach material that one is like intimately familiar with and try and wrench a little bit more emotion out of it and try to play it like it's fresh. That, to me, makes it worthwhile, even if I personally don't care for the song, in order to like be issued this challenge to play it to the best of my ability and to put emotion into it. Well, you couldn't ask for more, you know? As a musician, you couldn't ask for more. That's it. You know, that's what keeps me coming back. That song that I don't like, that I have to play a million times, that makes me a better musician, I'd like to think.
Each of us have, like, different biases, musical biases and everything. I think when we're on stage together, it's like, whatever we're playing, we're going to, like, do our best no matter what. And that's what makes the Gomers enjoyable to play with for me.
stop the believing. Do not stop believing.
Rockstar Gomeroki at the High Noon Saloon in Madison, Wisconsin, starring the Gomers. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon filed that report. You can find a link to the Gomers website on our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to the best of our knowledge's Facebook page on our website. Why not become a fan? Coming up, we'll check out a novel called The Karaoke World of Cortis Hare as we continue our Hour on Karaoke. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Bjorn Turman was born and raised in Vancouver, B.C., Canada, but he's lived in Asia since 1993. During that time, Turman has become more and more fascinated by karaoke. So fascinated that he's written a novel called The Karaoke World of Cortis Hare. Turman told Steve Paulson about the premise of the novel.
Well, on the basic level, the book's about this man, Cortis Hare, and he heads off to Singapore in early 97, really in search of adventure and a job, you know. He has very little money when he lands, and he's the son of a failed inventor from Winnipeg, Manitoba. And after some basic searching, he finds the job. Then his adventure begins. But on a broader level, I suppose, the book is really about one man's search for his big picture, and this is where I use the metaphor of karaoke to tell the story.
It's an unusual metaphor, I have to say, to use karaoke as the means of the great search.
Yes, well, I myself actually landed in Singapore with very little money and no job. So I can really relate to Cortis's adventures. And when I landed, I got a job at a local company in Singapore, and I was one of the first foreigners, if not the first foreigner they'd ever hired. And I was working with a lot of people who would say very little throughout the day, particularly in meetings. But then I'd go out singing karaoke with them, and, you know, they would have no problem standing up and banging out tune after tune without being embarrassed at all. And I thought, well, this is interesting. My fascination for karaoke videos grew rather rapidly. And if you've ever watched a karaoke video, they're pretty interesting, quite unique.
Mm-hmm. And well, for our listeners who've never actually seen a karaoke video, can you explain what it is?
Often the video has very little to do with the song. Certainly videos in the 90s, you know, they would tape, you know, for example, many of the videos I'd see would be, you know, a young woman sort of hugging a palm tree and thinking about lost love or something like that, or, you know, someone just marching through some unnamed city. I mean, it would really just kind of be background picture to the words scrolling underneath. But some of the videos, you know, were kind of interesting. And every once in a while, I'd point out these videos to my colleagues and say, wow, you know, that video looks really interesting. And they'd say, well, Bjorn, nobody watches the videos. They only look at the words. And I thought, wow, there's
which
a metaphor
does,
in
does
there.
Which sort of raise the question, why do they have the video in the first place then?
Yeah, indeed. And really nobody watches the videos because, you know, either it's a bouncing ball or, you know, words very quickly scrolling underneath. And your focus is on that, of course, so that you can sing the song. But, you know, as a keen observer of the karaoke industry, I became very almost obsessive about these karaoke videos. And I thought, well, you know, there must be a metaphor in there somewhere. And, you know, years later, I wrote this book.
Hmm. Now, you have quite remarkably actually written a novel about karaoke, and it figures prominently into, I mean, sort of this whole sort of quest for, well, finding a new karaoke star figures prominently in your story. Mm. And I'm wondering if you could read an excerpt from the story that and maybe set it up a little bit to explain how this works.
Okay. Well, Cortis Hare, he lands in Singapore with no money and no job, and after some searching, he finds this job as a karaoke marketing executive at this company called Lover's Walk Private Limited. And Lover's Walk makes karaoke videos. And his boss, the karaoke entrepreneur named Mr. H.Y. Sim, is this rather eccentric fellow who has a long history in the music industry. And the company's success really was due to their production of some pretty successful karaoke videos. So he hires Cordis Hare as the first foreigner in his local Singaporean firm. And, well, early on in the book, probably, I guess, one of the first few days into Cordis's tenure on his job, Mr. Sim comes to his desk and they have this discussion. And this is where I'll start reading. "I need a star, Cordis, a real star," said Mr. Sim, slapping the karaoke marketing report down on the marketing manager's messy desk. "Sorry, sir, you need a what? A star? Yes, Cordis, a star. The world's first karaoke video star. Someone everyone will love. Someone people will want to stare at for hours while they sing." He jammed a finger on the report. "They'll buy more home karaoke machines. Everyone in this industry will make more money." Cordis watched the wild eyes of his boss shimmer under fluorescent light. All around him, the buzz of responsible workers picked up the tempo. "We need to find this big star." Mr. Sim arched closer, waving his pointing finger back and forth between the two of them. "We need to sign her." He froze his pointing finger at the halfway point between them. "Yes, her, a girl, a woman. Everyone loves a beautiful lady, and we," resumption of finger back and forth, "need to do it quickly. Must do it quickly, Cordis." Yeah, no, absolutely. This is a great idea, sir. Something that should definitely be done quickly. And I agree. The big star should be female. A beautiful, sexy, female karaoke star. And just moving forward a little bit here. "I need her to be someone who has a lot of Asian appeal. I need her to be big in Laos," said the voice from behind him. Cordis bolted upright. "Laos? That tiny country near Vietnam? What's in Laos?" "Ever been to Laos, Cordis?" "No. No, I haven't."
So I have to ask you, I mean, you've already said karaoke is kind of a metaphor for life. Has thinking about karaoke or even writing this novel, has it affected your life in some way?
Yeah, you know, Cordis goes on, as I say, in this journey, and it's really a search for his big picture. And I've learned a lot about myself through, you know, living in Asia in the last 16 years. And my big picture continues to evolve. And
what have you learned about yourself that you wouldn't have if you had just stayed in Canada?
I think any time you're taken out of your comfort zone, you're gonna learn about yourself. You know, I landed in Singapore. I'd never been to Asia before. You know, I had very little money, no job. But what I did have was that wide-eyed fascination of being in a new country and having new experiences. And that fascination, you know, hasn't died. And, you know, I travel extensively throughout Asia, most of the time just for my own, desiring my own experiences. And I've seen and I've come across some interesting people who have really taught me a lot, you know. And oftentimes it's done just through broken English or my own ability to speak a few words in the local language. And, you know, I love those opportunities and hopefully they'll continue.
Bjørn Turman is the author of The Karaoke World of Cordis Hare. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Have you ever heard of Dictionaryoke? It's the brainchild of a diverse group of experimental musicians called the Snuggles Collective. These musicians use the spoken word audio clips found at online dictionary websites to create vocals that sing karaoke, or Dictionaryoke. Here's the Dictionaryoke version of Cameo's Word Up.
Ow! Yo,
pretty ladies
around the
world
got
a weird
thing
to
show
you.
So
tell
the boys, girls,
tell
your other, your sister,
and
your
mama too,
cause
we're about to
go down
and
you
know
just
what to do. Wave
your
hands in
the air
like
you
don't care.
Glide
by
the people.
Mama,
come on, baby,
tell
me
what
the
word a
word up.
Everybody
say
when
you
hear
the
call
you
got
to get it underway.
Word
up. It's a
code word. No
matter
where
you say
it,
you
know
that
you will
be
heard.
Now
all you
sucker DJs
who
think you're
fly
there
has
got
to
be
a reason and
you
no reason why
you
try
to
put
on the air
and act real
cool,
but you got to realize that you're acting like fools if
their music
we can
use
it. We're
free
to
dance.
We don't have
the
time
for psychological
romance.
No
romance.
No
romance. No
romance.
For
me,
mama,
come on, baby,
tell
me
what's
the
word.
A
word.
Ow.
That's Word Up by Cameo, Dictionaryoki style. You can find a link to the Dictionaryoki website on our website at ttbook.org. So what do you think of karaoke? Have you ever sung it? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website, ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll learn about karaoke capitalism and karaoke fascism as we continue our hour on karaoke. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Jonas Ritterstrahl is the co-author of the book Karaoke Capitalism, Daring to be Different in a Copycat World. He wrote the book with Kelly Nordstrom. Ritterstrahl explained the concept of karaoke capitalism to Anne Strangechamps.
Well, I think most people are familiar with the concept of a karaoke club, a karaoke bar. Although, for some odd reason, very few people are willing to admit that they've ever been to one, but they probably have friends who have told them about karaoke bars. You get to the place, you have a drink, and then you start singing, and in all likelihood, you're not very successful, so you drink again, and then you sing again. At the end of the day, a karaoke bar is just a place for institutionalized imitation. I mean, you essentially go there to be someone else. And really, no matter how talented you happen to be when you go to the place, you're bound to be a pale copy of an original. And I happen to believe that the current business world is absolutely full, smack-packed with these karaoke copying companies. And in business, we've even invented names for that imitation frenzy. We call it benchmarking, the sharing of best practices. And of course, the fact that we have global consulting companies, the fact that we have globally homogenized MBA education that more or less everyone is getting these days, that's a phenomenon that is way too prevalent. And the problem, of course, is that in today's hyper-competitive economy, there is extremely limited payback in playback. You need to be original. You need to be innovative, especially if you're up against 1.2 billion Chinese and 950 million Indians.
So what's the downside of karaoke capitalism? Because it seems to me for an awful lot of businesses, that's been a path to success.
Well, from a customer point of view, I think Bruce Springsteen summarized it pretty well when he said a couple of years ago, he wrote a song called 57 Channels and Nothing's On. I mean, this illusion of choice, because it doesn't matter if you go to company A, B, or C, it's the same thing. I would say that the downside from a business point of view is that unless you're a temporary monopolist, unless you are unique in either time or space, it's going to be incredibly difficult to make any money. And thirdly, I would add that it's kind of boring. I mean, a business should be fun. It should be creative. It should be unconventional. It should be something which is inspiring to people.
You've used karaoke as a kind of business metaphor for a world in which all the businesses are copycats. But in a karaoke club, there's another thing going on, which is that everybody wants to be a star. Everybody wants their turn behind the microphone.
We all want our 15 minutes of fame. Maybe today it's 15 seconds of fame, because the world has started to operate without any speed limits. You can be a local star at a karaoke club. I mean, you can get the local audience that happens to be at that particular pub to love you, but you will not become Madonna. You will never become the Beatles. You will probably not even become the Pussycat Dolls if you settle for merely performing at a karaoke club. And again, are you willing to settle for that as a business today? Because today, you essentially have the potential of ruling the world if you're good enough.
Jonas Ritterstrahl is the co-author of Karaoke Capitalism, Daring to be Different in a Copycat World. He spoke with Anne Strainchamps. Now that you know what karaoke capitalism is, do you think you can figure out what karaoke fascism is? Monique Skidmore is the author of Karaoke Fascism, Burma and the Politics of Fear. She explained karaoke fascism to Steve Paulson.
I wanted karaoke fascism to mean two things. First of all, it's about the way that the military regime links state power, links a really repressive form of authoritarianism with capitalism, and the way that there are no limits to the propaganda it can put out about the rosy future. It's a saccharine sort of future, and it's very divorced from reality. It's a spoof or a play on reality. And everyone in Burma knows that this manufactured future is never going to come to fruition. So that was one part of the metaphor. The other part of the metaphor is about the way that karaoke is a script. When people perform karaoke, they choose a script and they perform it. And the military regime has at times made comments in the state newspapers that the population of Burma has gone to sleep with karaoke culture. And I was really interested to see what that meant. And what I think is that Burmese people have chosen to enact and perform and speak in public, sing in public, if you like, all sorts of banal 1960s Western songs. So my best friend's favorite song in Burma is an old song called I'm on the Top of the World. So it's got very little to do with Burma and its current situation, but she's chosen a script that's entirely divorced from her real life.
So there's a veneer of conformity. People know how they're supposed to act in public and how they're supposed to come across to the military regime in power, but there is an entirely different private life that exists behind that public facade.
That's right, but because there is so little forms of expression allowed, all forms of association allowed in public life, karaoke is a place where people come together, young people, sing out loud to associate in public and to voice thoughts and scripts and ideas that are entirely different from the authoritarian script that the military regime is trying to get them to subscribe to.
Now, are you also referring to karaoke in the literal sense? I mean, are there Burmese people who hang out at karaoke bars and do this
Absolutely.
Kind of thing?
Absolutely. This is extremely popular. Even in villages of, say, 500, 600, 700 people, now you'll find a karaoke hat powered by a generator that young people will come to every evening to sing together. Your love's put me at the top of the world.
Monique Skidmore is the author of Karaoke Fascism, Burma and the Politics of Fear. She spoke with Steve Paulson. And what better way to finish a show about karaoke than with a little celebrity karaoke? Here's Glenn Tilbrook of the British band Squeeze with his karaoke interpretation of the band's 1981 hit, Tempted.
Some perfume, a fortune all for you, but it's not my conscience that hates to be untrue. I asked of my reflection, tell me what is there to do. Tempted by the fruit of another, tempted by the truth that's discovered. What's been going on now that you have gone? That's the weather. Tempted by the fruit of another, tempted by the truth I've discovered. Tempted by the fruit of another, tempted by the truth I've discovered. Tempted by the fruit of another, tempted by the truth I've discovered. Tempted by the fruit of another, tempted by the truth I've discovered.
What's been going on? Well, there's an ending we never had.
Glenn Tilbrook of Squeeze with his karaoke rendition of the band's hit song, Tempted. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 524B, Karaoke. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickert. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.